This is Dauchi's Biology, recorded the 8th of February 2022. Chem for Bio. Isn't this the coolest way to study? You're sitting on the bus or you're in the canteen queue with your AirPods in. Look around. Everyone who sees you thinks you're listening to some cool music. Well, let's let them think that, shall we? Just nod your head and tap your foot. I won't tell them what you're really listening to if you don't. It'll be our little secret. And in the meanwhile, let's study biology. Well, hey there, and welcome to Dauchi's Biology. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm guessing that that's because you're studying VCE Unit 3 and 4 Biology. You may not be, though. You may be from another state or even another country. Welcome if that's the case, but particularly if you're studying Unit 3 and 4 Biology in Victoria, especially welcome to you, because it's for you that I'm really making this podcast. My name's Andrew Dauch, or Dauchi, as many people call me, and I've been teaching biology for longer than I'd really care to admit. I love this subject. I love thinking about biology. I love talking about biology, and that's why I make this podcast. And I really hope that as you go through the year, that you will love biology as much as I do. You might be thinking, well, why even make or listen to a podcast like this? Why should you subscribe to the podcast? Why should you listen to a podcast about biology? After all, you've got a textbook that's got all the information that you need to learn. You go to class every day and your teacher explains biology to you. You might have Ed Rollo, and the guy on Ed Rollo explains biology to you as well. And by the way, if my voice is sounding a bit familiar to you, that's because I am the guy on Ed Rollo. But nevertheless, you know, if you've got all of those other resources, why would you want to listen to an audio podcast as well? Well, look, I think that it's a bit different. I think it presents biology in a slightly different way. It's going to be a little bit more sort of discussion-based. You know, we're going to talk about things. I'll go deeper on things here than you might go in some other places, sort of really flesh out some ideas, help you to see things perhaps from a different perspective. And I'll try to make it kind of conversational. You know, the idea is that you might be walking home from school. You know, you might have a 20-minute walk home from school. Why not listen to the podcast, you know, and you know, use that time productively if you're on the bus on the way home from school, or maybe, you know, while you're washing the dishes, or, you know, whatever it is you do. We've all got times in our day when you can't really be studying, you can't be using your hands or your eyes, but you can be listening and thinking. And so that's the idea. You know, you can fit some extra study into your day, but it doesn't even really feel like study because we're just talking about a subject that we love, right? And that's the point. And, you know, I imagine that if you're listening to the podcast, that it's because you want to do well in biology. Why else would you be here? So I imagine that you're the sort of student who really wants to excel in biology. And that's my aim, is to help you do that. In this particular episode, we're going to be focusing on chemistry. And I know that might seem really strange because, after all, you signed on to do Unit 3 and 4 biology, and the very first thing that we're going to talk about is chemistry. That might seem strange, but the reason I want to do that is because there is some knowledge of chemistry that I'll bet your teacher probably assumes that the textbook assumes that you know. I haven't explained it in Ed Rollo. Your teacher probably won't explain it to you because they imagine you've picked it up along the way in year 10 and whatever. But you may not have. Now, if you're a chemistry student, the stuff that we're going to talk about in this episode, you probably already know it. So maybe you can just stop now, come back next episode, and we'll be moving on and looking at proteins in the next episode. But even if you are a chem student, you might find that it's actually really helpful to go over some of this stuff again anyway, just to refresh your mind. And besides, we're focusing particularly on the chemistry here that's essential knowledge for biology students. Let's start by talking about elements. If you've seen a periodic table of the elements, you know what I'm talking about, this big chart that lists 118 different types of stuff that are sort of irreducible, you know, irreducible matter. You can't, you know, you can break things down into their to their elements, but you can't break them down any further. And there are 118 of those. An atom is a single particle of one of those elements. So you might have one of the elements, for example, is oxygen. You might have a single atom of oxygen. If you were to break that open somehow, or break it down, it would no longer be oxygen anymore. So you can break, you can get a whole chunk of oxygen, you can divide it in half and divide it in half and divide it in half, keep getting down till you get to a single atom of oxygen. You can't then divide that any further. It's the smallest amount of oxygen you can possibly have. We call that an atom. Now, of those 118 elements, I reckon there are six that you as a biology student need to be familiar with. Only six of the 118. And you don't even need to be all that familiar with those either. I think there are two in particular that you need to know the atomic numbers of. You know, the rest of them, what you mostly need to know is just a little bit about what they are. So let's talk about those now, shall we? The six that I think you need to know about are hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. I'll say those again. Hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. The first thing that I want you to know about those six elements is the color that represents them in a diagram. All year, you're going to be looking in textbooks and at various other diagrams, models perhaps hanging in the classroom of various different kinds of molecules that are going to contain these elements. And they're going to have, you know, the atoms in those molecules are going to be color-coded. And they're not just random colors, they're the same colors. You know, if you look in one textbook or another textbook, people will use the same colors to represent those different elements. So when you look at it and you see black, you should know that that's carbon. When you see red, you should know that that's oxygen. That helps you to interpret those models and those diagrams of the molecules that you're looking at. So let's go through the colors and we'll talk about them one by one. And hopefully you're going to find it really easy to remember which color represents which element. Let's start with hydrogen. Now, hydrogen is the smallest of the elements. It's the smallest element. It's only got one particle in its nucleus. It's element number one, we call it. And so the color white seems to be kind of an appropriate color. To me, in my mind, it seems like white is an appropriate color for the smallest element. And that's how I sort of always remembered it, white for the smallest of the elements. Carbon is almost always colored black or perhaps charcoal, you know, sort of a dark gray color. And I don't think that's random. In fact, most of the colors of the elements are not random. Carbon, of course, is black. If you have a lump of carbon, like think of coal or charcoal or graphite, you know, the graphite in a pencil, that's made largely of carbon. Carbon is a dark gray, blackish sort of color. So it seems like the perfect color to represent carbon in a molecule model. Oxygen is colored red. And again, to me, that seems really logical because if your blood is oxygenated, if there's a lot of oxygen in your blood goes bright red. Okay, so it seems to me, oxygen and red go hand in hand. And if you've done some physiology and you've learned about oxygenated and deoxygenated blood, then you know that oxygenated blood is bright red. And so it's easy to remember, oxygen is represented by the color red. Nitrogen is represented by the color blue. And again, that's a really logical color because 70% of the atmosphere is nitrogen. When you look up into the sky, 70% of what you're looking at is nitrogen gas. And so, and because the sky is blue, it seems really appropriate that we represent nitrogen in a molecule with the color blue. Sulfur. A lump of sulfur is actually yellow in color. Like if you dig a lump of sulfur out of the ground, it's bright yellow in color. So, of course, yellow is the color that represents sulfur in a molecule model. And the only one that's not really logical is phosphorus. Phosphorus used to be represented by the color purple, but in most modern diagrams, in most modern models, it's represented by the color orange. I don't know why it was ever represented as purple. And for that matter, I don't know why it's currently represented as orange either. Neither of those really make any sense to me. But nevertheless, that's the only one that you really need to just remember. And of course, you'll see all of these things, you know, in most of the molecules that we're looking at, you know, in DNA and in proteins and in phospholipids and, you know, most of the molecules that you're going to be learning about in Unit 3 and 4 biology contain these elements. They contain hydrogen and carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and, in many cases, phosphorus and sulfur. So, you know, knowing those colors so that when you look at a model and you see yellow, you know that's sulfur. When you see red, you know that's oxygen. It just helps you to interpret those diagrams. They're not just meaningless diagrams now, but you can actually see what's going on in there. It totally is worth the while just to remember which color represents which element. The only other thing that I reckon is worth probably really remembering, the only thing, well, not worth remembering, I shouldn't say that, of course, it's worth knowing everything you can possibly know about everything, but the only thing that you really need to know about the elements is the atomic numbers and masses of carbon and nitrogen. And you won't even need that really until you get to Unit 4 biology. But let's talk about it now anyway. Carbon has an atomic number of 6 and an atomic mass of 12. The atomic mass is double the atomic number. What does that mean? Well, what it means, in an atom, there are electrons orbiting the atom, and in the middle of the atom, there's a nucleus, and the nucleus is made of both protons and neutrons. The protons have a positive charge, neutrons have no charge at all, but the nucleus is made of protons and neutrons. In carbon, there are 6 protons and 6 neutrons. So we say that the atomic number of carbon is 6. That's talking about the protons. And the atomic mass of carbon is 12. That's talking about the total number of particles in the nucleus, both protons and neutrons. Right? The same exact thing applies to nitrogen. Nitrogen has an atomic number of 7 and an atomic mass of 14, because it's got 7 protons in the nucleus and 7 neutrons for a total atomic mass of 14, but 7 of those are protons, so the atomic number is 7. So if you can remember those two, again, that's going to just, when you get to Unit 4 and you're learning about carbon dating, which is a way that one way that we're able to date fossils to know how old a fossil is, you're going to need to know at that point, you need to know the atomic numbers and masses of carbon and nitrogen. So you might as well commit them to memory now. And then when you get to that part of the course, that's going to seem really obvious and straightforward. Okay, so we've looked at the what an element is, what an atom is, and we've looked at the colors that represent the 6 elements that I think you really need to know about to be successful in Unit 3 and 4 biology. Another thing that I think you really need to know about are different types of bond. This is one thing that a lot of students struggle with because there are so many different types of bonds. As you go through Unit 3 and 4 biology, you're going to hear all these different words of different types of bonds. You'll hear about covalent bonds and ionic bonds and hydrogen bonds. You'll hear about peptide bonds and disulfide bonds and dehydration bonds and condensation bonds. And it can be kind of confusing if you don't realize that there are actually only a few types of bonds, and that in fact all these different words describe different aspects of bonding. So let's talk about what I think you need to know. Firstly, let's start by saying that there are really 3 types of bond. The first type of bond is by far the most important. So let's start there, and that's covalent bonds. A covalent bond, they're the ones that you need to know about the most. And what a covalent bond is it's a bond between 2 atoms, where 2 atoms stick together because they share electrons with each other. And the reason that they do that is that electrons typically like to have, well, they when I say like, of course, they don't have brains, they don't have likes, but you know, let's talk about them as though they did. Atoms like to have a full outer shell. Now, the first shell has 2 electrons in it. So if it's got only, like hydrogen, for example, if it's got 2 electrons in the outer shell, then that's a full outer shell. But most elements would have 8 electrons in their outer shell. But typically, they don't, right? So if you take oxygen, for example, oxygen only has 6 electrons in its outer shell. And so by sticking to another oxygen and sharing 2 electrons with the other oxygen, it's kind of almost like it has 8 electrons in its outer shell. It's a little bit like if you have a pair of jeans and you have maybe a brother who has a pair of jeans. Well, now kind of you've got 2 pairs of jeans because you can borrow your brother's jeans and your brother can borrow your jeans. So, you know, between you, you've got 2 jeans each that you can both wear. You can, you know, your friends, as far as they know, you've got 2 pairs of jeans because they see you one day with 1 pair of jeans and another day with another pair of jeans. You only own 1 pair of jeans, but you effectively own 2 because your brother has a pair of jeans too, if you kind of get where I'm coming from. And that's how covalent bonding works. You have 2 atoms that both have perhaps a missing electron in their outer shell, but by sticking together and sharing an electron, they effectively have a full outer shell, and that holds them together. The thing to know about covalent bonds is a covalent bond is a very strong bond. And in fact, when we talk about a molecule, really by definition, a molecule is a particle made of several atoms held together by covalent bonds, right? So if you're looking at a molecule, like a molecule of DNA or a protein or an amino acid or sugar, glucose, something like that, and someone says glucose is a molecule, what they're saying is that the atoms that are in glucose are held together by covalent bonds. The atoms in a DNA molecule are held together by covalent bonds. And that's why I'm saying that this is really the most important type of bond for you to know about in biology as a biology student, because all these molecules that we talk about are structures that are created by atoms being held together by covalent bonds because they're sharing electrons with each other. That's what's holding them together. The other 2 types of bonds are less important to know about than covalent bonds, I think. But second most important are hydrogen bonds. A hydrogen bond is a weak force of attraction between hydrogen and usually something like oxygen and nitrogen. And it's not a strong bond like a covalent bond. Remember, covalent bonds are very strong bonds, very hard to break a covalent bond. But hydrogen bonds are very weak bonds. They're just this weak force of attraction. It's almost like, you know, if you've ever had that experience where you get a balloon, perhaps, and you rub the balloon on, you tear up lots of little bits of paper and put them on the table, and then you rub a balloon on your hair or something, and then you hold the balloon over the table and all the little bits of paper kind of jump up and stick on the balloon. Those sort of electrostatic attraction between the paper and the balloon is kind of similar to a hydrogen bond. It's this weak force of attraction between 2 separate molecules because of the attraction between hydrogen in one molecule and perhaps oxygen or nitrogen in another molecule. And so those 2 molecules are going to kind of be held together, but only weakly. And a good example of this, I mean, I know by this stage of your career, you will have learned about DNA, and you know that we have complementary base pairing between cytosine and guanine, and between adenine and thymine in DNA. Like adenine will pair with thymine and cytosine will pair with guanine. They don't actually become kind of, they don't stick to each other. They don't share electrons. It's not like they're forming a covalent bond. It's just that you sort of adenine and thymine kind of are attracted to each other. They'll sort of stick together almost a little bit like to a pair of magnets. They'll sort of stick to each other because they're attracted to each other. That's because of hydrogen bonds. But they're weak bonds. They can easily be broken. It's also hydrogen bonds that hold water molecules together. If you've ever seen, you know, maybe you've been in the shower and you see water sort of trickling down the shower screen, and you'll notice that as a water drop sort of trickles down the shower screen, it'll kind of go slightly out of its way to join in to another water droplet. Have you ever seen that? Like where the water droplet actually, it almost looks like the water is kind of attracted to other water. Well, that's because it is. It's because water has hydrogen in it and oxygen in it. And so the hydrogens of one water molecule are attracted to the oxygens of another water molecule. There's this weak force of sort of attraction between them. Those are hydrogen bonds. But you know how weak they are because, of course, water can easily be broken apart. droplets will fall away from other droplets and all that sort of stuff. They're only weak. It's a weak force of attraction between one water molecule and another water molecule. But nevertheless, it's important. And it's important in biology. I mean, we've already talked about DNA. The two strands of DNA are held together by the complementary base pairing of cytosine and guanine, and between adenine and thymine, held together by hydrogen bonds. And so you can see why understanding hydrogen bonds is important to you as a biology student. The third kind of bond is less important, and it's what we call an ionic bond. It's a bond between ions. And a good example of an ionic bond is the bond between sodium and chloride ions. Sodium has one electron in its outer shell. And what tends to happen is it tends to lose that electron, right? Because it wants to have a full outer shell. So by losing one electron, it ends up having a full, the next shell down is now a full shell. But because it's lost an electron, an electron has a negative charge, sodium now will have a positive charge, and we call it an ion, a cation to be precise, right? So it becomes a positively charged ion because it's lost one of its negative charges, one of its electrons. Chlorine, on the other hand, has one missing electron in its outer shell. So it'll tend to steal an electron to fill up its outer shell. But because it's stealing an electron from somewhere else, it ends up with one extra electron, one extra negative charge in its outer shell. And so a chloride ion is chlorine with an extra electron. And so it's slightly negatively charged. It's got an extra negative charge. So when a chloride ion and a sodium ion come near each other, because the sodium is positively charged and the chloride ion is negatively charged, they will stick together like a pair of magnets because opposite electric charges attract each other. All right, so they'll stick together, and we call that an ionic bond. They're not sharing electrons, they're just stuck to each other because one's positively charged and the other is negatively charged. They stick together. That's an ionic bond. Not as important to us in biology. It is, you will still come across it, just not as much as the other two. Now, before we leave this conversation about bonding, we haven't finished yet, because I mentioned all these other words that describe bonds, peptide bonds, dehydration bonds, all those other kinds of bonds. Where do they all fit in? Well, all those other types of bonds really are covalent bonds. Okay, so if you hear about a dehydration bond or a condensation bond or a peptide bond or a disulfide bond, what you're hearing about is a covalent bond. But those words are not describing the type of bond so much as some other feature of the bond. Let me explain what I mean. Let's go through some of those words and I'll explain what they mean. Let's start by talking about a peptide bond. Now, a peptide bond is a bond between two amino acids. Okay, so a bond between two amino acids is called a peptide bond. The word peptide bond doesn't tell you what type of bond it is. It tells you who is bonded to who, or what is bonded to what. It tells you two amino acids are bonded together. That's a peptide bond. It is a covalent bond. The way that those two amino acids are held together is by covalent bonds. But because it's between amino acids, we call it a peptide bond. A disulfide bond is a bond between two sulfur atoms. Okay, again, it's a covalent bond. So the word disulfide bond tells you who is bonded to who, or what is bonded to what, not how they're bonded together. A dehydration bond is a bond that, when it forms, releases a water molecule. Like a hydrogen breaks off one molecule and a hydrogen and an oxygen usually break off the other, and they join together and form water. When that happens, when a water is formed in the process of a bond being created, we call it a dehydration bond, because water's being lost. You know, like if you go hiking and you lose too much water, people say you're dehydrated, right? If two molecules bond together and water is released, we say that that's a dehydration bond. And when several molecules join together and they lose bits of themselves, so that the molecule we end up with is smaller than the sum of the molecules that were joined together to make that bigger molecule, we call that a condensation bond. Right? So if you get a whole lot of amino acids, for example, and you join a whole lot of amino acids together, if you get two amino acids and you join them together, they will lose a bit of themselves. One of them will lose an oxygen and a hydrogen. The other will lose a hydrogen. They form water. But what's left are two amino acid residues, that is two amino acids with little bits of them that have been missing. So we call it a condensation bond because that pair of amino acids now is smaller or more condensed than the two amino acids that we started with. So that one bond, that bond between two amino acids, is a covalent bond, which we could describe as a peptide bond because it's a bond between two amino acids. It's also a dehydration bond because it produces water as a result, it releases water. And we could call it a condensation bond because we end up with a molecule that is smaller than two amino acids because they've each lost each other. It's all four of those kinds of bonds in the one bond. Whew, well, if that's all new to you, you may even benefit from pausing, going back and listening to all that again. But we're going to move on now in the podcast and talk about what we mean by the term compound, and also what we mean by polar molecules, organic compounds, some of those other terms you're going to hear about and need to absolutely know what they mean. Let's start with the term compound. When something is described as a compound or a compound molecule, what we're saying is that it's a molecule, that is, it's a bunch of atoms held together by covalent bonds, right? So it's a molecule, but it contains more than one element. Okay, for us to describe something as a compound molecule or a compound substance, what we're saying is it's a molecule containing more than one element. So, for example, oxygen gas is two atoms of oxygen held together by a covalent bond. But we wouldn't call that a compound because it's only got oxygen in it. It's got nothing else but oxygen. Water, on the other hand, is a compound molecule because it contains both oxygen and hydrogen. Carbon dioxide is a compound molecule because it contains both carbon and oxygen. Glucose has carbon and oxygen and hydrogen, so we would call it a compound molecule. But nitrogen gas is just two atoms of nitrogen held together by a covalent bond, so we'd call it a molecule of nitrogen gas, but we wouldn't call it a compound molecule. All right, now some compounds are referred to as organic compounds. What does that mean? Again, this is another word that really causes a lot of confusion among students because you go down to the greengrocer or the supermarket and you see this little section that has organic tomatoes, and that sort of suggests that these other tomatoes over here are not organic, you know, because these ones are labeled organic and those ones are not labeled organic. So you sort of come to think, well, some tomatoes are organic and others are not organic. But that's a completely different use of the word organic to what we use in biology. You know, in a greengrocer, the term organic means that those tomatoes have been grown without the use of artificial pesticides and herbicides and things like that. That's what it means. But of course, that's not what biologists mean. It's not what chemists mean when they refer to something as organic. For us, if something is organic, what we mean is that it's a molecule containing carbon and hydrogen bonded to each other. Okay, so all organic compounds are, of course, compounds. They're molecules made of more than one kind of atom. And in that, they also, one of the kinds of atoms that they have is carbon, another of the kinds of atoms they have is hydrogen, and there are covalent bonds between the carbon and the hydrogen. That's what it needs to be organic. Let me just restate that. This is an important point. An organic compound is a molecule that contains carbon covalently bonded to hydrogen. So let's talk about a few examples. Carbon dioxide has carbon in it, but it doesn't have any hydrogen in it. So we wouldn't call it an organic compound. It's a compound, right? It's got more than one kind of atom held together by covalent bonds. So it's a compound, but it's not an organic compound because it doesn't have hydrogen in it. So there's no hydrogen covalently bound to the carbon. Glucose, on the other hand, has carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And if you have a look at a model of glucose, you'll see that on some of the carbons, there is a hydrogen bonded to the carbon. So we'd call glucose an organic compound. Okay. So again, just to reiterate, for it to be an organic compound, it first needs to be a compound. It has to have more than one kind of atom. And of course, that has to be carbon and hydrogen. And the hydrogen has to be bonded to the carbon. If it has that, we call it an organic compound. Okay, some molecules we refer to as polar molecules. What does that mean when you hear someone describing a molecule as a polar molecule? Now, if you have a look at a diagram of water, for example, is a really good example of a polar molecule. In fact, it's probably the best. It's the perfect example of a polar molecule. If you have a look at water, you'll notice that it's got one oxygen atom and two hydrogen atoms. They're covalently bonded together. That is, they're sharing electrons with each other. Each hydrogen has one electron in its outer shell. Oxygen has two missing electrons in its outer shell. So when an oxygen grabs two hydrogens, each of the hydrogens is sharing one electron with the oxygen. So the oxygen effectively has eight electrons in its outer shell now, and each of the hydrogens effectively has two electrons in its outer shell because it's sharing one with the oxygen. So it's a covalent bond, but the electrons are not shared equally. They don't spend equal amounts of time orbiting the oxygen and orbiting the hydrogen. And so as a result, the hydrogens kind of both end up on the one side of the oxygen. And again, if you don't know what I'm talking about, go and have a look at a picture, just Google, you know, oxygen molecule, and you'll see what I mean. You've got this red oxygen atom with two white hydrogen atoms bonded to it, but the two white hydrogens are over one side of the oxygen. They look like sort of Mickey Mouse ears, right? Both over one side of the oxygen. Because those hydrogens have, you know, sort of a positive charge and the oxygen has a negative charge, that means that at the oxygen end of a water molecule, there's a slight electrical charge, a slight negative electrical charge. And at the hydrogen end of a water molecule, there's a slightly positive charge. Overall, the water molecule is not charged. Okay, overall, it's neutral, you know, because all of the atoms have got a full outer shell. But because the electrons aren't being shared equally, the water molecule itself is slightly more positive at the hydrogen end and slightly more negative at the oxygen end. And as a result, water molecules will kind of stick to each other, hydrogen end to oxygen end, sort of attracted like the north and south ends of a magnet, like we talked about before. These are hydrogen bonds, right? Hydrogen bonds will form between the hydrogen of one polar molecule and the oxygen of another polar molecule. Right? That becomes really important when we're talking about things like membranes, right? It becomes really, really important. As you'll see when you get to talking about membranes or lots of other things in biology too, understanding what we mean by a polar molecule is really, really helpful. All right, fantastic. One other thing that I want to talk about in terms of molecules, in terms of these general terms about molecules, is the term biomacromolecule. A biomacromolecule is a big organic molecule found in living things, a biomacromolecule. Bio, of course, meaning life, macro meaning big, and molecule meaning, well, molecule. So a biomacromolecule, a big molecule found in living things. And there are four main kinds of biomacromolecules. There are lipids, carbohydrates, proteins, and nucleic acids. And again, I think it's good for you to be familiar with those four: lipids, proteins, carbohydrates, and nucleic acids. All of them are organic. That is, they all contain carbon with hydrogen bonded to it, as well as oxygen and other things in there as well. We talk about the subunits of a biomacromolecule as well. So a biomacromolecule, because it's a big molecule, it's made of smaller subunits that are all joined together. Like, for example, when we were talking about two amino acids joining together by a peptide bond, that's essentially what a polypeptide or a protein is, right? So a polypeptide is a big long chain of amino acids. It's a biomacromolecule made of a subunit called an amino acid. A lipid is a biomacromolecule made of subunits that we call fatty acids and glycerol. Nucleic acids like DNA are biomacromolecules made of subunits that we call nucleotides. And complex carbohydrates like starch are biomacromolecules made of subunits that we call simple sugars, or monosaccharides is another word for simple sugar. All right, so a big molecule made of smaller molecules all bonded together, then we call them, well, the big one we call a biomacromolecule. The small parts that they're made of, we call their subunits. All right. Some of those we refer to as polymers and monomers. Now, let me explain those terms as well. A protein is a big, or a polypeptide is a big long chain of amino acids. So we can refer to the polypeptide as a polymer, and the amino acids we can refer to as the monomers that are joined together to make that polymer. A complex carbohydrate is a polymer of simple sugars, because the simple sugars are joined together to make that polysaccharide, to make that complex carbohydrate. So we can refer to the complex carbohydrate or polysaccharide, we can refer to that as a polymer, and the simple sugars or monosaccharides we can refer to as monomers of that polymer. And the same is true with something like DNA. A nucleic acid like DNA or RNA is a big long chain of nucleotides. So we can refer to DNA as a polymer of nucleotides, or we can refer to a nucleotide as a monomer of DNA. All right? Fats are the weird thing. Fats and oils, these lipids, while they are a biomacromolecule, we don't refer to them as polymers, because even though they contain fatty acids and glycerol, they're not arranged in a big long chain of fatty acids and glycerol. They've got fatty acids and glycerol in them, but they're not arranged in a big long chain. So we don't refer to them as a polymer. And of course, their subunits we don't refer to as monomers either. Finally, in this episode, I would like to go through some words that describe molecules that I think are going to be really helpful to you, just to make sure that you know what those words mean. They're words that are, you know, just helpful. It's just helpful to know these as you go into biology. The first of them is the difference between the term protein and polypeptide. Earlier in this lesson, earlier in this episode, I talked about polypeptide and protein interchangeably as though they're the same thing, two different words for the same thing. Now, I referred to polysaccharides and complex carbohydrates. They are the same thing. Okay, but polypeptides and proteins are not quite the same thing. They're similar, but not quite the same. Let's split the hair that is the difference between proteins and polypeptides. The word protein is kind of a functional word, whereas the word polypeptide is more of a structural word. And let me explain what I mean there. We talk about a chain of amino acids. A polymer of amino acids is a polypeptide. Okay, that's a structural statement. It talks about what it is. It's a big long chain of amino acids. It's a polypeptide. But the word protein really describes the function of that molecule, because when a polypeptide is made, it gets bent and folded and often gets cut into several pieces and things get added to it. Maybe iron groups get added to it, or methyl groups get added to it, or bits get removed from it. And it ends up being this final structure in the cell that does some kind of a job. It might be an enzyme or a channel protein or a carrier protein or something, right? But that is what we refer to as a protein. It's a functional protein. It's the structure in a cell that does a job. That's a protein. And some proteins are made of several polypeptides that are joined together to make the one functional protein, right? Some proteins aren't. Some proteins are made of a single folded polypeptide, but there are lots of proteins that are made of several polypeptides. You know, some proteins are made of four or even six polypeptides that are all wound and joined together and form one structure that does one job. It might be an enzyme that does a particular job, but is made of several polypeptide chains, several different chains of amino acids. So that's the difference between the word protein and polypeptide. Another word that you may come across that is similar to that is the word peptide. We do use the word peptide to refer to a peptide bond, but you may just refer to it, someone might refer to a molecule as a peptide. Like, for example, they might say, this is a peptide hormone. Well, what does that mean? If someone says it's a peptide hormone, what does that mean? Well, what it means is that it's like a polypeptide, right? It's like a protein, but it's much smaller. So typically, if a molecule is made of 20 or less amino acids, we're going to refer to it as a peptide, not a polypeptide. A typical polypeptide will have more than 100 amino acids. Okay, so if it's got more than 100 amino acids, we're going to refer to it as a polypeptide. If it's got fewer than 20 amino acids, we're going to refer to it as a peptide, not a polypeptide, even though it's a chain of amino acids, even though it's a polymer, and it's made of the monomers that we call amino acids. The difference between the word peptide in reference to a molecule and polypeptide in reference to a molecule is simply the size, the number of amino acids in that chain of amino acids. Okay, good. A couple of other things that I thought would be worth mentioning are the endings of some names of molecules. Like you'll see a lot of molecules that end in the word ase, A-S-E. Whenever you see that, that tells you that you're talking about an enzyme. Ase is an enzyme ending, right? So, and you'll see that right through Unit 3 and 4 biology. You know, you'll learn about DNA polymerase, for example. What that tells you is that it's an enzyme that makes a polymer of DNA. And how do you like that? Just from the words we've been using in this lesson, DNA polymerase, it's an enzyme, that's the ase bit, that builds a DNA polymer. Pretty cool, right? So that ase ending, if you see that, you're looking at an enzyme. Now, there are some enzymes that don't end in the word ase, but the vast majority of them do. Sometimes you'll see a molecule whose name ends in in, I-N, and that tells you typically that it's a protein. All right, so if you see something like pepsin is a good example. Pepsin is an enzyme in our stomach that digests protein, right? Its name is pepsin, but that in ending tells you that it's a protein. Why it's not called peptase, I don't really know. That would be a better name for it since it's an enzyme, but of course all enzymes are proteins. So again, in, that in ending typically tells you that you're looking at a protein. And another word that's similar is ose. That's O-S-E. Whenever you see something ending in ose, you're looking at some sort of a sugar. So glucose, fructose, sucrose, lactose, deoxyribose, all of those are sugars. Okay, so and the ose ending, that O-S-E ending, that tells you that you're looking at some kind of a sugar. And the last word that I thought I'd just mention, because you may see it, your teacher won't use this word and you probably won't see it on an exam, but if you're looking on Wikipedia, if you're reading on Wikipedia or online somewhere, you're likely to come across the word moiety. That's M-O-I-E-T-Y. And what a moiety is it's an identifiable part of a molecule that we also find in other molecules, right? So, and a great example of this is when you're learning about DNA and you're looking at nucleotides, for example, you're going to learn that a nucleotide has several parts. It has a sugar, right? Usually perhaps deoxyribose or ribose, and it also has a nitrogen-containing base. Now, we could refer to that nitrogen, you know, maybe adenine, for example, is a nitrogen-containing base. We could refer to that nitrogen-containing base, adenine, as a moiety, and we could refer to the deoxyribose as a moiety of that molecule, because you can find deoxyribose in other places. You can find adenine in other places not attached to deoxyribose, right? And so those identifiable parts of a molecule that we also find in other molecules, we can refer to as moieties. And so, you know, it's a word I'm likely to use in this podcast from time to time because it adds clarity. You know, when we're talking, for example, about how we number the carbons in a nucleotide, it really helps to use the word moiety. It's not going to be on the exam. You're not going to have to, in fact, a lot of the words that we've used in this podcast, you're not going to need to use on the exam. You're not going to need to probably describe what a covalent bond is. It's helpful for you to understand what a covalent bond is. It helps, you know, because when you know that the bond between something is a covalent bond, you know that that's a strong bond, right? And so it's really helpful to know what we're talking about. you're not likely to get a question on the exam that specifically says, what is a covalent bond? In fact, I can almost guarantee you that you won't get a question on the exam that says, what is a covalent bond? But knowing what a covalent bond is will deepen your understanding of the things that you do need to explain on the exam. It will deepen your understanding of the things that you do need to be able to comprehend in biology. So that's really why I've started here, looking at the stuff we've looked at in this episode. You know, before we get into proteins and before we get into DNA and all of that really cool biology stuff, I think it's really helpful to have under our belt the terms that we've looked at in this episode of the podcast. And you may find it beneficial to listen to this episode several times if this is not, you know, if this is all new to you, right? If you're not a chem student and you haven't come across these terms before, can I encourage you, maybe listen to this a couple of times to get these words and terms under your belt, so that when you hear someone saying that a hydrogen bond forms between this and this, or a covalent bond forms between this and this, or this is a peptide bond, or this thing is a biomacro molecule, that you don't have to even stop to think, wow, now what does that mean again? That you just know it, you just understand it, because then you can really focus on the biology, not on the terminology that's being used to describe it. And that makes such a difference to your success as a biology student. Well, look, thanks for joining me for this first episode of the podcast. I know it's a strange one, talking about chemistry in the first lesson on biology, but I think it'll stand you in good stead as we move through the course and look at all the cool stuff that is in Unit 3 and 4 Biology. I'm looking forward to the journey, and I really hope you are too. If you have a question about anything that we've talked about in this episode, or anything else for that matter, feel free to ask it, and you can do that by sending an email to biologypodcast@gmail.com. And if you send a question there, I'll talk about it in the next episode. Also in the next episode, we're going to be talking about proteins and polypeptides, making sure we understand all about that in more detail than we've looked at in this lesson. So I look forward to seeing you back here. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.